Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 27, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on drunk driving and the Fourth Amendment, the implications of the Supreme Court's decision in Missouri v. McNeely. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I am the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Orrin S. Kerr, who is the Fred C. Stevenson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. We also welcome Professor Rory Little, who is Professor of Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. We're also pleased to have as our moderator Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice David R. Strauss. And more information on each speaker was provided to you ahead of time in the email, so I'll pause there and preserve more time for their presentations. So without any further ado, I am going to turn it over to Justice Strauss. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian, and thanks to all of you who have decided to call in and hear our podcast, and to our two participants, thanks for participating in this. What I wanted to do before we get to each of their presentations is to talk a little bit about McNeely and why we're doing this teleforum. As you may be aware, Missouri versus McNeely was decided about a year ago and dealt with whether or not police have to obtain a warrant in order to take blood from a suspected drunk driver. Many state courts, including the Minnesota Supreme Court, had held that the evanescent nature of alcohol, the fact that it can decrease very rapidly in the bloodstream, provided a single-factor exigency that warranted an exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. So many state courts have decided along those lines. The case for Missouri went up to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that the evanescent nature of alcohol in the bloodstream does not provide a single-factor exigency, and that instead, whether a warrant is required needs to be determined on a totality-of-the-circumstances approach. From my experience, this particular decision has caused a lot of uncertainty among state court judges and has been a source of concern for state court judges over the past year. And so I thought it would be a good idea to have a teleforum to talk to practitioners and state court judges and others who are interested in the decision to talk about some of the implications of the decision. We've decided to have Professor Kerr go first, followed by Professor Little, and then we will open it up for questions. So I will turn the floor over to Professor Kerr.
Thank you, Justice Strauss. I wanted to talk a little bit about what McNeely holds and doesn't hold and some of the confusion about how to interpret the case. I think of the McNeely case as kind of an example of the problem that happens when a court decides an issue so narrow that it leaves all the interesting questions open, and then it just sort of leaves the lower court struggling to figure out what's going on. So the majority opinion by Justice Sotomayor is very focused on the narrowness of the question that it decides. All the McNeely case decides is that it's not a per se rule of exigent circumstances when there is a drunk driver based on the concern that the alcohol in the bloodstream will naturally disappear over time. That does not create automatic exigent circumstances, and that's all the court holds in McNeely. So the court in McNeely doesn't even answer whether a warrant was required based on the facts of McNeely itself. Instead, the court just says, we're only sort of taking this abstract legal question, is there a per se rule of exigent circumstances, basically because of the nature of how the body works its way through alcohol in the bloodstream, and that's it. That's sort of the only question it handles. And the court's concern, the majority opinion's concern, is that there would be circumstances in which you can imagine it would be easy to get a warrant. And the court doesn't want to say that there are those circumstances and yet there's a per se rule that no warrant is required. And what might those circumstances be? So imagine a case where a drunk driver is pulled over by the side of the road, and it just so happens he's by the side of the road right next to the courthouse And the local magistrate judge just happens to be returning from dinner or returning from lunch and is standing in front of the courthouse. And the officer pulls over the driver and finds that, in fact, he's intoxicated, arrests him for drunk driving and wants to get a blood draw because the person will not consent to a blood draw. And it turns out the hospital where they would do the blood draw is an hour away. Well, the judge is right there, and the hospital is an hour away, so there's not going to be any delay if one of the two officers, say, that have pulled over the driver gets the judge to sign off on the warrant before they actually withdraw the blood at the hospital. And the court is thinking, well, if it's the case that there are going to be some situations where it's easy to get a warrant and it doesn't add any delay, we would not want a per se rule that the officers can just ignore the magistrate judge who's right in front of them, and instead they can just withdraw blood whenever they want, either on the scene or at the hospital or wherever. And so the court just says, all we're saying is that there's no per se rule that they can always go without a warrant. And what they don't answer is, when are the circumstances in which the officers do need a warrant? And the court suggests it's kind of, as I read the McNeely majority opinion, and I'm interested if Professor Little agrees, the court seems to be saying something like this. If it's possible to get a warrant and not too inconvenient, officers should. If it's not so possible, or if it's really inconvenient or would add too much time or would really hurt the case in some way, then it's not required. And the hard part is figuring out what's the line between those two, and the court hints at some factors, you know, how fast it would be to get a warrant, how convenient it would be to get a warrant, how much delay it would cause, without saying that anything is really outcome determinative or even sort of the leading indicator. So the court just leaves open this big question as to when a warrant is required. And I'm sympathetic with Chief Justice Roberts and his partial concurrence, partial dissent. Just says, you know, an officer reading this opinion would have no idea, and he emphasizes no idea, that as to what to do and to when to get a warrant. And I think that's basically right. I think Chief Justice Roberts is right, that the court has answered one question but really just created a lot of other questions, because you just never know now, at least ex ante, whether an officer should get a warrant. My advice to officers in the field, I think, would be you should probably try to get a warrant in every drunk driving case, or at least create a record as to why it's not going to be feasible to get a warrant to draw blood when blood is going to be drawn without consent. That it seems to be some sort of a good faith efforts test that the court majority would likely adopt if push came to shove, but they don't say anything explicitly on it in the McNeely decision, so it's left for the lower courts to have to try to figure out. Justice Kennedy concurred in McNeely. He did not join the entirety of the Sotomayor opinion, so parts of it are a plurality opinion instead of a full opinion of the court. And Justice Kennedy says, well, you know, eventually we can come up with some sort of rules to cabin this idea. And Chief Justice Roberts, is a separate opinion, tries to come up with a separate rule, and Kennedy does not even want to respond to that rule. He really wants to leave this open to lower courts. But the Roberts idea was a warrant is required if you could think that it wouldn't extend the period of the blood draw. So if it can be done in the period before the blood draw would be taken, then that should be okay. And then the majority or the plurality opinion does not like that for various reasons. So there's sort of a disagreement among the justices as to how far to go and what exactly the test should be. But I think if you're a lower court, at this point you just say, wow, McNeely just created tremendous confusion and does not really answer any of the important practical questions, such as, you know, how do you know when a warrant can be obtained? So that's the confusion, I think, that McNeely creates. And then there's an additional question, which several state courts have grappled with in the year or so since the McNeely case, which is, what's the interaction between McNeely and implied consent statutes? So all 50 states have some form of implied consent statute. If you're pulled over, and usually it's going to be if you're arrested, you've sort of said that you will consent to a blood draw if necessary, or a breathalyzer test if necessary. And if you withdraw that consent that you have given upon agreeing to drive on the roads of that state, then you can be punished in various ways. And in most jurisdictions, there's a withdrawal of your license, revocation of your license for a period of time. And in Minnesota, which has been the subject of a lot of litigation on this question, it's actually a crime of refusing to consent. So interesting question. What do you do about the intersection between those two statutes or those two principles? One being, you know, are implied consent statutes a way of obtaining consent to the search? So, of course, the basic Fourth Amendment rule is that a warrantless search is allowed if there's valid consent. And so you might say, first, does the implied consent statute itself generate consent? And then second, if a person is pulled over and told about their that it is a crime, say, in the jurisdiction not to consent, and then they agree, they waive their, they agree to go along with the implied consent statute, is that a voluntary consent under the Fourth Amendment? That was an issue that the Minnesota Supreme Court decided in the Brooks case, which I believe now was last year, and the majority of the court concluded that it was still voluntary consent under the totality of the circumstances when the individual who'd been pulled over had been told of the implications under the implied consent statute for revoking the consent. Importantly, the Brooks case did not consider the issue of whether implied consent statutes themselves generate consent, and I would think the answer to that has to be that they don't, because consent is a question of fact, ultimately. The Supreme Court has actually been kind of cagey about how you construe consent. Is it a legal question or a factual question? I think it's really a mixed question of law and fact. But the existence of the statute, I don't think, is actually generating consent, especially when it is triggered when an individual is actually saying, no, I refuse to consent. So it's hard to construe the refusal consent as actually some sort of consent. But that was not an issue that the Brooks case from Minnesota actually grappled with. Instead, it was if an individual had been told, and in that case was told, about the implications if they refuse the blood draw or breathalyzer test, that they could be punished. Was there basically giving in the face of those consequences, making the consent a valid consent under the Fourth Amendment? So a lot of really interesting, difficult questions. I just looked on Westlaw yesterday, and there are several cases from Texas dealing with the implications of the McNeely case. Under Texas law, a refusal to consent is actually under the statute, it says if somebody refuses to consent, you can do the blood draw anyway, essentially relying on the notion that the implied consent statute is consent, and then taking the blood draw. And several intermediate state courts in Texas have said that's not permissible and that's unconstitutional and have struck down those statutes, and that's an issue that's sort of working its way up to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. So a lot of lower court litigation trying to figure out not only when is a warrant required, but also what's the intersection between the McNeely case and the implied consent statutes. And I guess my quick summary of it would be, it's a big mess out there, and it's probably going to make its way back up to the U.S. Supreme Court. One interesting aspect, as Justice Strauss mentioned, this is largely an issue that comes up in drunk driving cases that are primarily state cases. You certainly can get drunk driving cases in federal court, but it's going to be much more rare. I think the interesting question is, you've got different state statutes, for example, in the implied consent context. A lot of states that are grappling with what McNeely means just in terms of the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if between the 50 state Supreme Courts, you're going to get disagreement, which forces the Supreme Court to take a closer look at the issues in McNeely and actually provide some answers the second time around. So this may just be round one of several rounds of Supreme Court decision-making trying to give a little more guidance than it did the first time. And with that, I'm delighted to pass it off to Professor Little.
Professor Little?
Great. Thank you, Justice Strauss and Professor Kerr and all the people that are listening. I'm not sure who the listeners are, but this case raises issues in two very different directions. One is the sort of doctrinal issue of the Fourth Amendment and what is the Supreme Court doing more generally with the Fourth Amendment. They are struggling, the justices today on this court are struggling with how the Fourth Amendment applies in situations that the framers did not have much indication would come up. DNA, cheek swabs, the very important case that's pending right now in front of the Supreme Court, searching a smartphone, mini computer that we carry in our pockets when it's incident to arrest. What about dogs who can sniff narcotics? What about electronics that can sniff narcotics? And the justices are shifting, and to me one of the most interesting things is that Justice Scalia, often viewed as a conservative law enforcement oriented justice, is now voting routinely and strongly with the side of the court that is enforcing a very strong vision of the Fourth Amendment and the warrant requirement, and he was with the majority in McNeely. And meanwhile, Justice Breyer, appointed by a Democratic president, of course, is siding very consistently with the folks on the other side. And I think they're all struggling with, gee, what does this mean for privacy today? And I think the McNeely case comes up in that context. Now, the question on the other side is, what are the practical, granular applications and realities that officers have to face every day? So I'm going to try to talk about both of these. The McNeely case, I think, I agree totally with what Orrin Kerr said. I think this is really a very limited decision. And I think the majority was simply confronted with the idea, should we endorse categorical situations where a warrant doesn't even have to be considered? Should we endorse complete police discretion in certain categorical situations? Or should we remind the law enforcement community that there is a judicial role to be played under our understanding of the Fourth Amendment, and that our normal rule really is, if you can seek a search warrant before invading someone's privacy, or in this case, invading the surface of their skin with a blood draw, you should consider getting a warrant. And I think the majority simply saw it as a time to draw a little bit of a line in the sand and say, well, we're going to re-endorse the concept that there's a judicial role to play when officers are seeking evidence for criminal use, and we're going to say that categorically, this can't be done in the DUI blood draw situation, which makes sense in the sense that exigent circumstances, which is viewed as the exception to the warrant requirement, exigent circumstances is almost by definition a case-by-case concept. That is, do the facts of the case suggest that there was an exigency such that a warrant would have intruded upon very valid governmental interests? The general governmental interests that are thought most strongly here are safety. Will getting a warrant delay us so that safety is endangered? Or destruction of evidence? Will this allow evidence to be destroyed? And, of course, in the blood alcohol situation, evidence is being destroyed every second. That is, presumably once you're arrested, you're not drinking any longer. Your blood alcohol actually may go up slightly after you've finished your alcoholic consumption, but then it begins to decline pretty steadily and pretty quickly. So you can't delay, say, 6 hours and get anything close to a valid reading of what somebody's blood alcohol was at the time of the arrest. So the McNeely case has justices sort of wanting to draw a theoretical line and say, you know, you have to consider a warrant when you can. And then I'm actually very attracted by Justice Thomas's dissent. He's the lone dissenter in this case, where Justice Thomas says, well, imagine a hypothetical where one guy is unloading the contents of a warehouse. The police believe that all the bundles in the warehouse are full of narcotics, and this one guy is taking the bundles out one by one and dumping them in a bonfire out in the parking lot. Can't the officers go in on an exigency without seeking a warrant first? It's usually not viewed as an argument that says, well, there'll still be some evidence left by the time they get the warrant. Normally the idea is if they're destroying evidence, they should get a warrant. I think that's a very powerful hypothetical, and I don't think the court doesn't address it at all in any of the other opinions. And I think that where this will cause some confusion, actually, is the application of exigent circumstances to other situations other than DUI. I think it's most important to note that Justice Kennedy writes a fifth vote concurrence normally this necessary fifth vote concurrence, which Justice Kennedy has got some reputation for writing, is viewed as a controlling opinion. And what his opinion says is, look, just because we say there's no categorical exception doesn't mean that law enforcement agencies can't adopt, and here's the phrase he uses, rules, procedures, guidelines, and protocols. The idea that you can still develop general rules and protocols for the typical DUI arrest, even if you normally have to consider also, is there time to get a warrant? And in California, of course, which has quite a large number of DUI cases every year, there have already been district attorney's offices. The Alameda County District Attorney has issued a standard form search warrant for DUI blood draws, which the plurality opinion in McNeely actually seems to endorse in one part. Justice Kennedy seems to say, well, that's not going to be inappropriate. So long as you've got reasonable guidelines in place, you can go ahead. I agree with Professor Kerr that Chief Justice Roberts' concurring opinion could easily become the rule out there. There's nothing in the plurality opinion that says we flatly reject the rule. The plurality simply says this is not a case where we can develop any rules. Justice Roberts says, you know, if there is time to get a warrant before you could get to a blood draw medical facility, then you should get a warrant, or you should seek a warrant. If you seek a warrant and then you get to the hospital and the warrant has not yet issued, he suggests exigency should allow you to then draw the blood. And all the justices seems to be a little worried about a prospect of roadside blood tests. That is, what if we train police officers to be able to do the blood draw right on the side of the road? Then Justice Roberts' rule would never come into play. It would always be quicker to draw the blood than to get a warrant, even if the magistrate were standing across the street. The one comment I've heard from state judges here in California is it's not as easy to get an electronic warrant or a telephonic warrant or an oral warrant as the majority seems to think. Chief Justice Roberts actually suggests that you can get a 5-minute iPad warrant in some counties or a 15-minute electronic warrant. It's really not that easy. Most of the procedures that are currently in place are pretty cumbersome. You have to produce a written document. There has to be a duplicate document at the other end. Somebody has to sign it and swear to it. So it takes a little while. It's the idea that there's a 5-minute warrant procedure, I think, is a bit of a myth. And certainly there are lots of jurisdictions where there is no such procedure in place. So I think what's interesting to note is where will the justices – there's no doubt in my mind that this is just round one. And the plurality opinion actually invites round two. The plurality opinion seems to say there are rules and protocols that could be developed, but this is not the case to do it. Bring on the next one. And I think you'll see this perk for probably 3 or 4 years before the Supreme Court intervenes again and wait to see what jurisdictions adopt differing approaches. On the question of what about consent, the implied consent statutes, I think what's interesting to note, and Justice Strauss would probably not say this himself, but Justice Strauss wrote a separate opinion in the Minnesota case where he said, you know, this really isn't consent when somebody has sort of signed when they take their driver's license, I hereby consent to a blood draw. When they're on the scene and they're advised of the consequences and they say, well, we would rather have the consequences than have our blood drawn, we withdraw our implied consent. It's hard to describe that as a voluntary consent. There's some police agencies on the West Coast that have written opinions saying McNeely now requires the ability to withdraw your implied consent. California has a criminal provision which says refusing consent can subject you to criminal liability. Whether that statute will be upheld in the future is open to grave question. But in any case, even if you could be somehow convicted for not giving consent, I don't think if the cops go along and compel a blood draw by holding you down, that will later be viewed as consent because of the implied statute. So I think Justice Strauss also was right in his separate opinion when he said, you know, there's a good faith thing here. When police are relying on what they believe is the settled law to act without a warrant in a blood draw case. So what is the effect of McNeely on cases that were already, the blood was already drawn prior to McNeely being decided? I think those will generally be upheld on a good faith basis. There is an argument the Supreme Court's never endorsed the sort of lower court appellate theory on this, but I think that Justice Strauss is probably right on that. And so the question is, what happens going forward? I think in California, officers are now not compelling blood draws without warrants in the very small number of cases where somebody is told what the consequences are. You're going to lose your license for a year or 2 years or 3 years. There may be other consequences. It can be used against you in a proceeding for DUI, and they still refuse. That's a very small number of cases, but I think officers are not proceeding without trying to do the standardized warrant procedure. Although when they're it's a long distance to the hospital or somebody's not on duty and it's going to take a long time, then I think they can go ahead, and nothing in McNeely would prevent them. I'll say one other thing. I think on the general level, this is not unlike a case from 1997 called Richards versus Wisconsin. The Supreme Court had written in a case prior to Richards that the police must knock and announce whenever they're executing a search warrant. They have to knock and announce. It doesn't have to be very long, but it's got to be a knock on the door, "Hey, police," before you go in. And that's a constitutional requirement, even though it's not textual in the Fourth Amendment. In Richards, Wisconsin had said there's a categorical exception for narcotics searches. When you're searching for narcotics and you have a search warrant, you don't have to knock and announce because it's always likely evidence will be destroyed. The majority in Richards said, no, we reject that categorical exception. You're going to have to do it case by case. Now, the reality is, since Richards, in almost all narcotics or firearm search cases, officers explain why they have articulable suspicion that evidence might be destroyed if they knocked and announced, and then they go in without knocking and announcing, and those are routinely upheld. And judges can write a no-knock and announce clause into a search warrant, and those are routinely upheld. But it has to be on a specific case-by-case showing. And if you know nobody's home, and so there's no danger and there's no evidence destruction, then you don't. Then you do have to knock and announce. So there is some value in this idea that there's a judicial role to be played when the circumstances suggest that it won't adversely affect the government or the public to find an exception. So with that, I think I'll stop and let Justice Strauss maybe guide the discussion or listen for questions from our audience. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Little. I think that Christian is going to open this up to questions here shortly. But before we get started with that, I did want to ask both of our panelists a question, which is, both of you did a great job of talking about the various consent theories that I've seen advanced in various state court opinions. But there's one theory out there that a lot of prosecutors are arguing on appeal, and that I've actually seen discussed in some of the appellate court decisions, and that is a search incident to arrest theory. So to take Professor Kerr's example, the police stop a drunk driver on the side of the road. Unfortunately, there's no magistrate there, but based on the conduct, the fact that the person is not able to stand up straight, the officers have probable cause to arrest the individual for drunk driving. And one of the things you can do when you arrest an individual is do a search incident to arrest. And I'm wondering whether either of you think that that theory has much merit.
Well, Justice Strauss, this is Rory Little, and I'm happy to go first. Orrin, Karen and I may disagree on this. I don't think search incident to arrest is going to work very well, given the McNeely case. The McNeely case, rightly or wrongly, rejects the idea that the inevitable physical destruction of your blood alcohol content is sufficient to dispense with the Fourth Amendment requirements. The search incident to arrest exception is generally based on the idea that someone who is arrested could either reach for a weapon and use it to harm the safety of the officers, or could reach for evidence and destroy it, either by eating it or ripping it to shreds or whatever. And neither of those circumstances is really present in the drunk driving arrest situation. That is, the arrestee can do nothing to interfere with the process of the evidence destruction that is happening chemically in the body. I do agree that it's happening, and I am still attracted to Justice Thomas's dissent, his hypothetical, but the majority seems to have clearly rejected the idea that that's sufficient to dispense. So We're also going to learn a lot more about the search incident to arrest exception when the court decides these smartphone cases that are pending this term, the Riley case from California and the Rory case. Those two decisions, which I expect to come out pretty close to the end of the term, may tell us more about how the court currently thinks about search incident to arrest. But I'd say that in this situation, given McNeely, that's going to be controversial.
Yeah, this is Orrin Kerr. I agree with Professor Little that I think it's hard to make a search incident to arrest argument, and that's true for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think we've seen search incident to arrest applied inside the body, at least explicitly. You know, one case where that was what the court was arguably doing was the Schmerber case from 1966, but McNeely, you know, construes that differently. So I think after McNeely, it's unlikely that the court will say, oh, you know, we spent all this time in Missouri versus McNeely dealing with exigent circumstances, but you can do exactly the same thing under the search incident to arrest exception. I just think it's unlikely that they would say that that otherwise similar exception actually applies and we just sort of forgot to mention it. So I tend to think that that's probably not a viable theory.
Thank you. Christian, can we open up the floor to questions from the audience?
Absolutely. So for those of you on the line, we can now open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. So again, to get in line to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. And Justice Strauss, I don't know. Oh, there we go. There we go. First question is on the line.
Hi. Thanks so much for your discussion so far. Very, very interesting. I have a question coming from Florida. We have a statute that's the forced blood draw statute, which states that when an officer has probable cause to believe that an individual has caused a DUI accident resulting in serious bodily injury or death, the officer may forcibly draw the blood with or without the driver's consent. And I'm wondering what your guys' thought is on that, considering this discussion of whether implied consent factually is valid consent or whether it's coercive consent. But, you know, in Florida, we do have this statute that's called the forced blood draw statute, and I'd just like your thoughts on that issue.
This is Orrin speaking. I think it just, in any particular case, the question is going to be, was there, in fact, exigent circumstances to justify the blood draw without a warrant? So effectively, you know, the statute, assume there's no question of informing the individual about the implications and whether any consent would be voluntary, or you know, assume that maybe the simpler case where the individual just refuses to consent, the officer forcibly draws the blood. We're stuck in the same issue we saw in Missouri versus McNeely, and the statute, I think, doesn't make any difference. There's a separate question of whether where it's a crime to punish an individual for refusing to consent, whether that statute is still whether punishment can be allowed for the criminal violation, or whether there's an unconstitutional conditions problem, and an individual can't be punished for asserting their Fourth Amendment right effectively. And I don't think there's an easy answer to that. One thing that makes it difficult is, you know, do you construe the statute as basically saying, I promise to consent, and then if you don't consent, the crime is really sort of breaking the promise, or do you construe it as the individual being punished for asserting their constitutional rights? Sort of two different ways of construing it, and I think, you know, there may be an unconstitutional conditions problem with one approach and not with another. So that's a separate question of what can be punished constitutionally. But I think the analysis, at least as I see it, would be just, you know, were there exigent circumstances or were there not at the time that the blood was actually taken?
Yeah, this is Rory Little. I agree with Professor Kerr. We do have that same forced blood draw doctrine out here in California. There's a statute that says that there's implied consent, and then the court cases have all said that you can use a reasonable amount of force to draw the blood, even though someone doesn't consent on the scene. The general thinking out here among law enforcement appears to be that McNeely puts that in grave doubt. And the idea that the seriousness of the felony effect, so it's a drunk driving case where there are fatalities or where there are quite life endangering injuries or lots of property damage, that has often not been viewed as sufficient to dispense with the Fourth Amendment. There's an old case called Mincy versus Arizona where the government was requesting an exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement for a murder scene search. That when you're searching the scene of a murder, there should be an exception to getting a warrant. The Supreme Court said no, so long as you can get a warrant and it's not an exigency. So I think you'll have to do it again case by case. That doesn't mean that you can't develop general rules about when you should seek a warrant or when you have to wait for a warrant versus when you don't, because I think Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion controls on that. But those rules, I think, will have to be related to other factors than the seriousness of the injuries, because presumably waiting for a warrant doesn't change the seriousness of whatever the injuries are. So that's where I'd go on that one.
All right. Well, we have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you would like to ask a question, remember to enter star and then the pound key.
Thank you for the insight, guys. This is Jack Park. In a prior lifetime, I saw a case, drunk driver in Gulf Shores, Alabama, causes an accident. It's a serious accident that results in injury to him. He's airlifted to Florida where they draw blood, taking him into the hospital for treatment. Are the blood test results there fair game for the prosecutor in Alabama?
Could you expand on that a little? So the blood is drawn as part of medical treatment for this person?
Yeah, as a part of medical treatment over in Florida, because that's in the nearest hospital to take him to.
Yeah, I mean, this is Rory Little. I would find it, I would think if the blood is drawn for a valid purpose, and you know, then you come under maybe you come under a special needs exception analysis or something, but it's drawn for the purpose of medical treatment. It now provides evidence. I would think that the officers would be able to use that. Now, maybe they would have to seek a warrant to get the results of that blood test from the hospital, but I don't think that would be a problem. I mean, that's another point of McNeely. We all believe that these warrants for blood test results are going to be issued. It's a very unusual case where a magistrate is going to say, no, I'm not going to issue that warrant, which is cuts both ways, right? It means it's not a problem to impact the interests of the government. It also makes you wonder, well, why bother? And so, again, the majority in McNeely seems to be stressing the theoretical value of the magistrate. But in reality, you're going to get that evidence, I think.
Well, just an observation that in reality, the hospital probably wouldn't release without a warrant or a subpoena anyway. So you're going
right.
to have to get it.
But you're going
to
get it.
You are going to get it. It just takes the process. Thanks much.
And there's value to that process. I mean, this is Rory Little again, but I think there is. I agree with the plurality of the court and the majority that there is value to that process. Again, the Fourth Amendment was written in by the framers as a protection against executive branch intrusion. And to get a little theoretical here, we have to remember that the framers of the Fourth Amendment were all crooks. They had all committed a very serious crime. They had committed treason against their government. And they had often been subjected to law enforcement excesses in their mind by the British authorities. And they'd been tried in absentia, and they had been searched on general writs by the British soldiers. And so when they wrote the Fourth Amendment, they intended to put a little bit of a blockade in the way of evidence collection. And so there's value in the process The question is, you know, when do you sort of reasonably, and that's why the word reasonable is in there, allow the government to bypass whatever the protections are. Certainly, it just seems to me if you're in the hospital and somebody's drawing your blood, then you're going to be stuck with those results. I don't think that McNeely is a ticket to let drunk drivers off the hook.
Thank you.
Christian, do we have other callers on the line?
Yeah, we've got one more question, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you'd like to jump in, we've got about 20 minutes left. Press star and then the pound key.
So it's David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley, California. Thanks for the presentation. It's very enlightening. On the question of the agency, sort of the threshold issue as to whether there's the strength of the agency sufficient to justify the drawing of the blood. There's a couple of questions and points. I mean, I've read different numbers, but one number is roughly that there are 1,000 drunk drivers on the road for every one who is apprehended at any given time. So your thoughts on whether or not the exigency is a general concept or is specific to the incident at hand in front of the officer in terms of the legal arguments justifying it. If 999 drunk drivers can be driving with the evidence in their blood dissipating slowly, and we're okay with that, then how do we justify the specific case of the one being such a strong argument that we can, you know, violate or create an exception to their expectation of privacy? That's one point. And the other point is that there's, in addition to the criminal proceeding, there's often a parallel administrative proceeding at the DMV, where refusal to agree to a breathalyzer test or whatever results in an automatic suspension of driving privileges for an extended period of time. I believe in California it's a year or so. Again, relating to the exigency, if there is a backup penalty, then, and that penalty is fairly severe, does that undermine the argument for why we need to push so hard on the blood draw?
This is Orrin Kerr. I think the question is not sort of how hard we're pushing on the blood draw. It's really just a question of whether we're getting warrants before having the blood draw or doing it without a warrant under the circumstances. And so I think in terms of the first question, measuring the exigency, yeah, the court talks about the significance of drunk driving, and there's certainly some precedent for the idea that you sort of weigh the overall significance of the crime in figuring out the scope of exigent circumstances. At the same time, I think at bottom the real issue is just, okay, there's a criminal case, there's evidence that's being destroyed, when should we require a warrant to before the government can go in and get that evidence that's sort of on its way to being destroyed? And the reason I think the court is struggling with this issue is there's just that inherent balance. It's really a confidence level question of sort of, okay, you can get the evidence, but maybe it won't be quite as good an evidence. The evidence won't be quite as good. You'll be giving the defense an argument that actually the blood alcohol level was something different than it was because a certain number of hours elapsed and you don't quite know how long it's going to take a warrant. So the court is sort of grappling with the factual uncertainties of all these cases, and it's why they're not adopting a rule. But I think that the question, at least as the majority of the court is approaching, and really most of the justices are approaching it, it's really just a question of what do we do in a case where at one level evidence is constantly being destroyed, and yet at another level there are going to be cases where the government can get a warrant before the bulk of the evidence will be destroyed, and we would want to have a warrant requirement. So it's really just an evidence destruction rationale versus a warrant's preference rationale, and they're kind of grappling between those two. I don't think kind of the broader struggle over drunk driving is really necessarily directly implicated in the question.
Yeah, this is Rory Little. I certainly don't disagree with anything that Orrin has said. I'm certainly happy to hear somebody from California on this call as well. David, thanks for joining. you know, this problem of drunk driving is a hugely serious problem, and officers could spend sort of all their time enforcing drunk driving laws, and no other crime would be detected. It's always a balance. The Supreme Court, of course, has endorsed the idea of DUI checkpoints. So, in other words, in that, and this may be one of the cases Oren was referring to, but in the Sitz case, the Supreme Court said, you know, this problem is such a bad problem, we're going to let police stop everybody on a particular street, you know, with fair notice, et cetera, and we're going to let them do a very brief interference with their privacy, if you will, to see whether there's reasonable suspicion to wave them to a secondary place and see if they're drunk drivers. That hasn't been allowed. These sort of fixed checkpoints has not been allowed with regard to, say, narcotics or other things. We know in certain parts of urban areas today that if you searched everybody in a five-block radius, you'd find 100 firearms violations. And the Fourth Amendment has generally been construed to prohibit that. That individualized suspicion is generally the rule, rather than broad-based suspicion. And that goes all the way back to the framers, who didn't like the British practice of issuing writs that would allow searches of neighborhoods. You know, let's search all of the neighborhood in Boston for those revolutionaries. And so that's always been a tension. We know with a fair degree of certainty that random searches in various areas would yield evidence of crime, and yet we require individualized articulable suspicion. And so this McNeely case is sort of an example of how you're going to balance those difficult competing concerns. You know, on the administrative loss of driving, you're absolutely right that it's a loss of your driving privileges for a year. And I believe that will be upheld even after McNeely, that when somebody is arrested for drunk driving and is told, here's your choice, you will lose your license for a year or you can submit to a blood draw, and they say, well, I'll choose losing my license, I think that's a choice that's going to be upheld as voluntary. If they said, I will choose the blood draw, I think there's an argument that is consent as well. I think once you threaten them with criminal liability, you know, we're going to put you in jail if you don't submit, then that undercuts the idea of a valid consent. And, of course, the issue of consent is always a difficult balance between how much of it is a true choice among legitimate pressures and how much of it is overwhelming somebody's will by an unfair pressure. And, boy, the Supreme Court has struggled with that for years and never given us a lot of clear guidance. So I think the administrative penalty structure will yield valid consents in drunk driving cases very often, although I notice in Minnesota that you have the right to consult with an attorney first. You do not have that right in California. And the attorney in the Brooks case advised his client, well, just take the loss of driving, submit. Of course, Brooks was arrested for drunk driving something like five or six times. So in some cases, the facts will be overwhelmingly in favor of just absorbing whatever the penalties are.
I'm going to go ahead and sort of take the moderator's, personal privilege here and ask one more question of the panelists, which hasn't been covered by either of their presentations, which is one of the things that's interesting about this case is the interaction between this case and other Fourth Amendment cases the courts recently decided. And one such case is Maryland versus King that dealt with a cheek swab, and one of you, I think, mentioned it. But one question, you know, is that there's three ways potentially, at least three ways, I think there may only be three ways to obtain blood alcohol levels of drunk drivers. One, of course, is the blood test, and that's the most intrusive of the three. The other two are the urine test, which is sort of a middle ground, and then there's also the breath test as well, which really, the way most of these machines are set up, only gives the police information about blood alcohol level and nothing else. And so the question I have for both of you is, does the rule of McNeely and the analysis of McNeely extend to less intrusive procedures to determine blood alcohol level?
This is Roy Little. I think that's a fascinating question, Justice Strauss. I just think that's it's very hard to reconcile Maryland versus King, which is allows the officers in any situation to take a cheek swab for DNA, and McNeely, which says you've got to get a warrant in some cases at least before you draw blood for DUI. You remember in the dissenting opinion in the Maryland versus King, Justice Scalia wrote a very strong, vehement line, something along the lines of, I find it hard to believe that the proud men who wrote the Fourth Amendment would have submitted to the British soldiers swabbing their cheeks. So that's his dissenting view. And, of course, he's in the majority in McNeely. Obviously, a breathalyzer or even a urine test is less intrusive than piercing the skin with a needle, but they both involve some invasion of privacy. That rationale in King, which has sort of been difficult for some people to accept, Justice Kennedy, I believe, was writing, and he said, this is really identification. We're doing the DNA swab not to gather evidence of the crime, but to serve another purpose, which is identification. That might distinguish King from McNeely. In McNeely, clearly the purpose of gathering the evidence is to allow a criminal prosecution for drunk driving. And possibly that's a distinguishing factor, but I don't think Justice Kennedy, I don't believe the court opinion in McNeely adverts to King at all. And they were decided around the same time. And it's not clear to me that Justice Kennedy thought about, well, what is my unified theory of the Fourth Amendment? I'm not sure that Justice Kennedy has such a unified theory, whereas Justice Scalia, I think, believes that he does. Justice Breyer, I think, believes that he does. So I don't know what the answer is, but I could see certain distinguishing factors that might say that McNeely's will apply to other non-consensual evidence gathering techniques.
This is Orrin Kerr. I think McNeely and King can be distinguished on a bunch of different grounds. The primary one just being that this was really solely a question of the scope of the exigent circumstances exception. That was the issue in McNeely, and King was really just a question of effectively an administrative search doctrine of a search for identity purposes not relating to developing the evidence of crime, as Professor Little said. And I think as a result, they end up in just different doctrinal boxes. And I'm not surprised that the court would not have referred to the King case in the McNeely case, or really sort of seen any crosstalk between the two of them, just because they end up in different doctrinal boxes of exceptions to the warrant requirement. And there are so many different exceptions to the warrant requirement. And they have slightly different histories and doctrinal pathways that it's not uncommon for the court to decide two different cases that seem sort of factually similar, but since they're dealing with different exceptions, they just sort of end up being different boxes, and they don't talk to one another. So I don't think it's too surprising on that ground. I think going back to the big picture here. The justices tend to decide Fourth Amendment cases on a really case-by-case basis. And, Justice Scalia has said that he hates Fourth Amendment cases because each case is just, variation 3,792. It's just everyone is so fact-specific, and he wants something that's sort of a more elegant, sort of clear, coherent theory. And what's tricky about Fourth Amendment cases is that they are so fact-specific. There's so many different law enforcement practices that get regulated, so many different types of searches, types of seizures, so many different practices, the whole Pandora's box, as Anthony Amsterdam once said, that end up getting regulated based on the very textually simple prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures, that it's not surprising that we would get cases that seem kind of similar and yet end up just being slotted for these different categories.
Let me just follow up a little bit on what you said, Orrin, and I think what Orrin said is exactly right. The other King case that this brings to mind is Kentucky versus King. Kentucky versus King is an exigent circumstances case decided a couple of terms ago with Justice Roberts writing, where officers go to what turns out to be the wrong apartment, knock on the door, hear some scurrying noises inside, and blast in without a warrant. Turns out it's the wrong apartment, but they do find drugs, and so the people are prosecuted. And Justice Roberts writes in an opinion which nobody really seemed to disagree with, that this is an exigent circumstance. You knock on the door for a valid reason. You're allowed to knock on someone's door. You hear some scurrying noises, you have reasonable belief that evidence may be destroyed, you're blasting without a warrant. I'm not sure how Kentucky versus King gets reconciled with McNeely, and certainly Justice Roberts might agree. The Chief Justice wrote separately in McNeely to say, and dissented in some sense, to say, you know, we need better rules than what the majority is giving us. So, and Warren is exactly right. The justices approach these cases fact by fact, case by case. In that sense, McNeely is not so surprising. McNeely says that officers should do it the same way. It has to be fact by fact, case by case. We're not going to write categorical exceptions. The problem is the practical effect that it has on law enforcement, where officers, in some sense, don't care what the law is. They would just like to know what the law is so that they can follow it and not get sued and not have evidence suppressed. And so I do think you're going to see a lot of pressure on the Supreme Court to take another case sometime soon, depending on the variations that various state courts give to these issues.
Christian, do we have any other questions in the queue?
We do not at this point. So if we want, we can go ahead and give a last call for questions. So with about 4 minutes to go, if you'd like to get in one last question, press star and the pound key. Otherwise, there is probably time for one more question, Justice Strauss, if you want to pose it, or we can take concluding statements from each professor. So it's up to you.
Well, let me go ahead and ask one interesting aspect of McNeely and the analysis is, you know, states with good systems. So I think Professor Little mentioned this, states with, and I haven't seen these, but states with systems for getting quick warrants, for example, the iPad, the 5-minute iPad warrant. In those states, police are going to have to obtain a warrant. But in states where the process is particularly burdensome and slow, you may have to wake up a magistrate judge or you know a normal judge in the middle of the night to obtain a warrant, and that may take time. In those states, at least under the pluralities analysis, it seems as if you don't have to obtain a warrant necessarily in those particular states. That seems very perverse to me, and I'm wondering if that seems perverse to both of you, and whether or not we see this in any other Fourth Amendment cases or any other Fourth Amendment context where states are essentially, I wouldn't say punished because punished is not the right word, but states that have good systems now have to go through more burdensome procedures than states with poorer systems.
This is Orrin Kerr. I agree it's a hypothetical implication of the majority's view or the plurality's view. I'm not sure if push comes to shove they would actually stick with the view that you kind of look state by state or jurisdiction by jurisdiction. It's not clear to me that they would sort of, you know, ultimately follow through with that idea. I mean, it is implicit in the warrant requirement if the idea of the warrant requirement is that, you know, about exigent circumstances. If the basic idea is you don't have to get a warrant if it's hard to get a warrant, then the difficulty of getting a warrant becomes part of the Fourth Amendment test. And as you say, sort of perversely, if the state makes it harder to get a warrant, then maybe there's less of a need for one. But I wonder if, you know, over time, either the court would say, you know, we're going to have effectively a national answer to this question rather than a case-by-case or state-by-state answer, because it just does become hard to administer a rule where you look, you know, maybe how do you even know kind of how long it would take to get the warrant? Is it this magistrate is particularly slow? You know, I happened to call, you know, it happened to be magistrate Smith on duty, and boy, he takes forever, and therefore I couldn't get a warrant. And it's going to be tough for them to administer that kind of a rule, and so it may be that theoretical concern drops out once the court has to actually come down with some clear answer to when a warrant is required and not required.
Yeah, this is Roy Little. You know, the tradition of the Supreme Court is to ignore sort of state-by-state variations by denying cert. I think what you're going to see is at the state level, you're going to see different prosecutors' offices advancing reasons why they did not get a warrant, and some of them are going to pass muster. That is, some state appellate courts, Supreme Courts, are going to say, well, that's a valid reason, and others won't. So what you will see over time is sort of a general standard of what is the reasonable process for getting a warrant. If a state were to tomorrow repeal all of its warrant procedures, repeal its electronic telephonic warrant procedures, and said, you know, we'll only allow a warrant to be issued when you're in person, I'm not sure what a court would say, but I could imagine some state Supreme Court saying, well, you know, that's just not reasonable in today's world. You've got to have an electronic system. There is some precedent. The Supreme Court has ruled that you've got to bring somebody to for a probable cause hearing within 48 hours of arrest. You can't hold them for longer than 48 hours without a Fourth Amendment problem. There's a case in Alaska where somebody is arrested by some law enforcement officer in the you know, greater wilds of Alaska, and it takes them about 3 days to snowshoe to the closest place where they can get any kind of process. And the Ninth Circuit says, well, you know, that's understandable. We understand that. That's not unreasonable. Alaska is different than New York City. So I think you're going to see that perk up, and I don't think the Supreme Court is going to intervene on those sorts of variations over time. So there will be a lot of development on the state level.
Interesting. So I think we should probably go ahead and wrap up. Do either of you want to make sort of a closing statement, or do you have anything to say that you haven't said already?
This is Professor Little. I feel like I've exhausted the field here. I am interested to know what's happening out there in the real world, and there's a dearth of information out there. So your listeners or practitioners, it would be valuable to – I'm happy my email is pretty accessible through the Internet. I'd love to hear what is going on with McNeely out in the trenches. Thank you very much for letting me participate.
This is Oren Kura. Please CC me to the emails to Professor Little. I'm also really interested in seeing what the lower courts are doing, because it's an ongoing process, and I think it'll be back up at the Supreme Court before too long.
All right. Well, thank you very much to both of you for your participation in the teleform, and for all of you who decided to dial in and join us. I'll leave it to Christian to do any sort of administrative stuff that we have to do at the end of the call, but thanks again for all your help.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all three of our speakers today, Professor Kerr, Professor Little, and Justice Strauss, for an excellent discussion. Thank you for our audience for calling in and providing some great questions. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Quick programming note, our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow, Wednesday, May 28th at 2 p.m. on the state of state and municipal debt, with Professor Sanford Levinson from the University of Texas and Professor David Skeel from the University of Pennsylvania. Also, remember to check out the videos from the second annual Executive Branch Review Conference, now online at our website. So until the next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.